Green Scene on the Pat Kenny Show with AIB, offering Irish businesses practical knowledge and support to become more sustainable. AIB, for the life you're after.
Well, now in studio with me is the outgoing Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, still in situ until his successor, along with the other ministers of cabinet, is sworn in by the President. Stephen, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Thanks for having me on. Delighted to be here.
It's a kind of a twilight zone you're in, isn't it? You know you're not going to be doing the job after the 22nd of January, and yet you have to still do the job now. It needs to be done.
Yeah, it does need to be done. So through December and January, obviously, there was a big focus on the winter surge. We're now hopefully on the right side of the big flu surge. So I've been working very closely with Bernard Gloucester and with the department on a range of things. Obviously on the winter response, on getting HRT ready, on the new capital plan. This year, there'll be the biggest health investment in capital, I think, in the history of the state. So getting that ready. We launched the National Service Plan, which is essentially the nuts and bolts of the health service. What's going to be delivered for people around the country this year? We launched that earlier this week. So, yeah, there's still a lot of work to be done in the background.
Now, from your own point of view, do you have a plan after next week?
I'm going to take at least a week off and sleep in, you know, like the last 5 years in particular, but the last number of years it's been very, very intense. I have three sons. I was looking, I was taking my photographs off the Department of Health laptop. So I was looking back at 5 years worth of photographs. Mm. And my oldest is 15, and he was 10. He was a child when I went in. And you know, there's photos of me and him, and he's a young boy at 10 years of age. He's now 6'2" and looks down at me and is a young man. So to be honest, Pat, I have a lot of catching up to do. You know, I'm immensely proud and honoured to have had the opportunity to serve in government, to be the Minister for Health. But it did mean that I wasn't the dad that I need to be, and I probably wasn't the husband and the son and the brother and the friend I needed to be. So there's a lot of catching up to be done.
What do you think went wrong? Because a high-profile minister, they're always regarded, unless they make a total hames of things, as a shoe-in. Do you know? And you didn't make a total.
If you know, thank you.
Yeah, it was a total hames of things.
Thank you. Too many things went in the wrong direction. The constituency redraw, had that not happened, I think I would have taken a seat. Simon becoming Taoiseach. We share the same town 6 months before the election. Had that not happened, I think I probably would have taken a seat. And health is a difficult ministry. You know, what gets covered and what we discuss nearly all of the time in healthcare is the things that aren't working for good reason. And we don't talk about the really important progress that gets made. And
it's
so,
sort of eaten bread, soon forgotten.
No, I think it's that when
when kids getting access to GP care, for example. That's, once you have it, it's a given. It's like the ratchet on a tennis net. You ratchet it up and it doesn't go back down.
Yeah, there'll be a bit of that. But also, you know, the people are kind of listening to what's coming in. They're seeing what's coming in on social media. They're listening to the news. They're listening to political discourse. And the discourse on healthcare focuses on what's not working. And so there is an imbalance in you know, all of us understanding actually there are huge challenges for patients, for our healthcare workers. But over the last 5 years, there's been an awful lot of progress. So politically, you know, they call it the poison chalice. It turns out for a reason. You know, there's only three sitting Fianna Fáil TDs didn't get re-elected. And it's interesting that two of the three were health ministers, me and Anne Rabbitt. So when you put all of those things together, it just didn't work out. I came forth on first preferences. I needed the transfers to work. I needed people to back the progress in healthcare and what needs to be done over the next 5 years in healthcare. And thousands did. And I am grateful to everybody who voted for me. But on the day, it wasn't to be. Look, I ran four times. I'm immensely honoured to have been put in the Dáil by the people of Wicklow three of those four times. And this time it just wasn't to be.
Is it a particularly difficult ministry to run? Because you have the Department of Health, which is your ministry. And then you have this monolith that is the HSE, which is, a hydra-headed snake almost. You know, there's so many elements to it. And it must be hard for a minister to get a handle on an organization that is kind of separate but subservient to the Department of Health?
There's a huge amount to it, yeah. In terms of the complexity of portfolios, certainly other people I've spoken to who've been in health and in lots of other portfolios have said there's nothing close to the complexity of healthcare. You know, I came from a healthcare background. I was doing healthcare before I ran for the Dáil in 2011. I had been the opposition health spokesperson, and it took me 3 years to really understand the mechanics of it. And then remember, in 2020, we took over a healthcare service which had huge challenges. You know, waiting times had gone up and up and up. The trolley numbers had gone up and up. It was starved of investment. We had some of the lowest numbers of beds per capita, some of the lowest numbers of hospital consultants per capita. Productivity, which is, we don't talk about much, but is one of the most important changes in the health service. Productivity had been falling year on year for many years.
This would be the number of patients processed through, if you think of the hospital as a factory, the number of people going in and coming out better at the other end per number of consultants or per number of nurses or whatever. That's the way you'd measure it.
Yeah, so let me give you just one example. It's the one I focused on with the HSE and with the department, which is the number of outpatient appointments per consultant. So if you take 2016 to 2020, a lot more money went into the health service. We hired a lot more people, but actually the number of outpatient appointments didn't go up. It stayed flat. So the number of outpatient appointments being delivered per consultant was falling each year. So in spite of investment, we weren't, patients and the taxpayer weren't getting the return they needed. Oh, there's lots of reasons. Partly because the HSE didn't have a culture of productivity. It didn't have the information you need to measure productivity. It didn't have e-health. We have been a laggard
on
e-health.
We're still not there with the electronic patient records. We've got a plan, I think, have we?
Well, we've more than a plan. So we've a plan and we've money and we're 1 year into the plan. What we're going to see shortly enough now, we'll all have, is a patient app, which will store basic healthcare information. That's the first step. The most important step is happening next year. This will be a game changer for patients. It's called a shared care record. And what it means is, if any of your listeners are talking to their GP, their pharmacist, their physiotherapist, or they're in hospital, the clinicians will now be able to pull up your full record. They'll see your MRIs, they'll see your X-rays, they'll see your previous treatments, and that's okay, going to be a game changer.
But you have to have a unique patient identifier. Now, yeah. I often wonder, why don't they use the PPS, for God's sake? It's our own working identifier. From the moment of birth, you get a PPS number.
Yes, that is what's going to be used. So I got government agreement some time back that PPS is exactly what would be used. And that the most important part of that is next year for the shared care record. And then the third phase, which is the really expensive and really complex one, which the patient won't see, but our healthcare workers will, is the full digitization of our health service. So the elements you need for high productivity simply weren't in place. We didn't have the information. We didn't have a culture. And there were structural changes we needed. So over the last 3 years, you know, we brought in the new consultant contract. We're moving from 5 days to 7 days a week working.
Why did that take so long? I mean, Bernard Gloucester made certain noises about it when he took over as the boss of the HSE. His predecessor had talked about it, but didn't make much progress. Why does it take so long to do something that has been talked about for decades? You know, for example, my wife would know about lab work. There was talk of shift working for lab workers 30 years ago, and it just never happened.
Yeah, these things, they do take a long time. You're talking about fundamental changes to how people work. Our healthcare workers and their unions, quite rightly, have to be consulted. They have a very clear view on what they want. The consultant contract probably took a year all in, but it was worth the effort, because what we have now is we have a new contract. It's a public-only contract. So we're phasing the private care out of public hospitals, which is so important. And under the new contract, the consultants can be rostered to work in the evenings. They can be rostered to work on Saturdays. They're getting paid more money, a good bit more money for that. But it's one of the productivity changes we needed. You see, the problem is, Pat, that the incentives in the system were all wrong, right? So here's how it worked. We said to any of our doctors, excellent women and men, we said to them, look, you're on a contract. No matter how many public patients you treat, we're paying you this wage. But for every additional private patient you treat, you're going to get more money and we're going to pay the hospital more money. So we were incentivizing our workforce and our hospitals to treat more and more private patients in a public service. That's why the public, the new consultant contract is so important.
Also insuring doctors, paying the insurance premiums for doctors, and that would cover their private work.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the taxpayer through the public service was subsidizing private care.
Do you think that systems are nimble enough? For example, you know, you have a list for the operating theatre and that's great and people are lined up and they're in the night before or early morning or whatever, they're fasting. And then it turns out that maybe a porter's gone sick or a theatre nurse has gone sick or an anaesthetist has gone sick. So everything is cancelled. In the private hospitals, they'd find somebody else. They lift the phone and say, I need an anaesthesiologist now or for 10 o'clock. Can you get one in?
You know, in fairness to the public service, in the public service, things like the absence of a porter or a nurse would not cancel your surgery. The main thing that would cancel your surgery is they'd say, we don't have an ICU bed or a high dependency bed or a ward bed ready for you. So back in 2020, again, we'd one of the lowest level of hospital beds per patient. Like, one of the things we have in Ireland is we have some of the best trained, most dedicated healthcare workers that I've ever seen. And I've been around the world and, you know, talked to a lot of healthcare ministers from a lot of different countries. But they have not been enabled to do the job that they need to do. They didn't have enough beds. They didn't have enough access to diagnostics at the weekends. We didn't have enough ICU. We didn't have enough specialists. So over the last 3 to 4 years, we've been changing all of that, but with a quid pro quo. So the very clear deal with the health service has been the state, the taxpayer, we will invest in you at a level that has never happened before. We've hired nearly 30,000 more staff. We're building thousands more beds. But we are going to do that in line with a new culture that says we are going to measure what happens in the public health service. To your point, Pat, so that the kind of efficiencies we see and flexibility we see in private care happens in public care.
Now, the problems that you've left, shall we say, for your successor, at the Children's Hospital not finished, it looks like the manpower planning, you may know more about this than we suspect, is out in the public domain. It seems to be grossly inadequate, and it doesn't look like 2026 might not be fully staffed. It might be 2027 before we have a hospital that's really fit for purpose open in St. James.
Well, can I say this? With a fair wind and with, you know, no unexpected things going wrong, I believe we should be treating patients in the new hospital at the end of this year.
At the end of 2025?
At the end of this year. We, as you'll be aware, I pulled in the global chief executive of BAM. We got a direct commitment, not from BAM Ireland, but from Royal BAM, that they would stand over their latest deadline. We got agreement that the commissioning teams could go in early. That hadn't happened before. And so with a fair wind, we should be treating patients at the end of this year. And then, of course, the hospital will grow. The one thing I will say, and you and I are at one on, you know, the Children's Hospital is something I inherited in 2020.
But it's in the wrong place, as we know.
Well, look, it is where it is, right? What I will tell you is I've been in children's hospitals around the world, including in the US, you know, including in Australia. This hospital will be one of the finest anywhere in the world, and the care that our clinicians will be able to provide in there will be second to none.
The GP shortage, it's seemingly acute around the place, and even the way GPs work nowadays, I say, why isn't there a Saturday service when you've got a multi-practice GP, you know, this multi-GP practice, you've got 7 or 8 GPs, and yet they can't manage to open on a Saturday, when a lot of people, you know, need to go to see a doctor, they have to take a day off to go to see the doctor. You know,
yeah,
it doesn't seem the right way to do things.
It can be very frustrating. And
you get a vet more easily than you get a GP.
There are certainly parts of the country where people simply can't sign up to a GP. So what happened? The number of GPs was growing, but the population was growing much faster, right? And we remember the CSO revised its figures and, you know, there was an extra 500,000 people in the country rather than a much lower increase that had been projected. At the start of this term, I want to really pay credit to the Irish College of General Practitioners and to our GPs. We sat down at the start of the last all term and said, OK, we have a shortage of GPs and it's going to get worse. The population is going up quicker than the number of GPs. And as GPs will tell you, the younger GPs, they don't want to work the mad hours. that were worked 20, 30, 40 years ago. You know, they want to actually, heaven forbid, have a life.
But that's why the collectivization of practices seem to be the way forward, so that everyone does a weekend, but it's only 1 in 8 weekends they do.
Yeah, yeah. So what did we do? We sat down with the ICGP and we said, we need a massive expansion in the number of GPs. So what we've done is we've tripled over the last 10 years or so, but particularly over the last 3 years, we've tripled the number of GP training places. There is a huge number of applicants for them, record number of applicants going in. But of course, it takes several years to train a GP. What we're seeing this year for the first time now is the graduating classes, if you like, are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the ICGP's projections are that we'll be up to the level they want, which is the Scottish level of number of GPs per head of population, I think in about 4 or 5 years. But because the pipeline is now bigger, that's going to keep going. So increasing access to GPs, so important, particularly because we've invested so much more in general practice. So chronic disease management, free contraception, menopause clinics, you know, there's a lot of things, access to diagnostics. There's a lot more GPs are doing. The pressure is real, and I know a lot of people are very frustrated by it. That pressure will begin to ease now in the lifetime of this government.
You mentioned in passing all the things that GPs are now able to do and should be doing. HRT introduced, and the products are free. Mm. The bits and pieces to get the products are not necessarily free. You got to go to your doctor and so on and so forth. Or maybe, I don't know, is there a prescription fee that people have to pay?
A dispensing fee.
So it's not absolutely free, but still it's welcome, I'm sure, because these products can be expensive. Why was it not all the ducks in a row for the 1st of January?
Well, it was never the 1st of January, it was January. So when we announced the scheme...
And it's still January.
It's still January, right? When we announced the scheme, we said that the state will be ready to go in January. The state will be ready to go in January. The HSC believes it will be ready in about 2 weeks. So you know, in the time that we said, the HSC will be ready. Now, we have to be very fair to an understanding of the pharmacists, because it's one thing for the HSC to be ready, but then a lot of the pharmacies have to update their systems in the background as well. And so it may take more time. But to the question of what I hear a lot of pharmacists saying in the media, and they said it to me, was you should have made it all free, just like we did with free contraception. Mm-hmm. The free contraception scheme has been really successful. It's worked very well. And we would love to go there. But I had €20 million available, which is a lot of money. And I had two choices with that. We could either make it free, you know, the GP and the pharmacy dispensing fees, we could do it all of that for free, but only for about half the women who were taking HRT.
So you've made it universal.
Or, we could make it available for all women, but in that case, we could at least in year one start by covering the medicine. So I'll give you just a quick example, right? I got this from the HSE yesterday. So for a woman who's going in, say, for three different products to do with HRT into her pharmacy, the cost of the medicine to the pharmacist might be €40. The pharmacist might then put a markup of about €20 on that, which would be normal. And then the pharmacist might charge a dispensing fee of €20, say about €7 per item. So the cost before this scheme to the woman would be €80. What the state is going to cover is the cost of the medicine and the €20 markup on that for the pharmacist. So the cost to the customer, to the woman going in, will fall from €80 to €20. That's a saving of over €700 a year. And can I just say, because I've heard an awful lot of coverage on this over the last while from the pharmacists, we know that they would like their dispensing fees to be covered by the state as well. That's something that a future minister may look at in a budget, or it might be part of the talks with the pharmacy union. There's €50 million on the table. But I spoke to a lot of people about which way to go with this, a lot of women and a lot of clinicians, and the overwhelming answer I got was, you can't exclude anybody. You have to include all women. So that's the way we've gone. I think it is the right approach.
A comment from a nurse. The Children's Hospital, wrong place, no parking for nurses. I'm an agency nurse. I will not take work in Beaumont or St. James because there's nowhere to park my car.
Look, I'm not going to defend the
design,
you know, certainly decisions and design that was made. It was something that I inherited. However, when you talk to clinicians who've had a tour of the place, like I was in Temple Street not that long ago for a a visit as minister. The conditions for our, and Crumlin, like, well, I was a regular visitor to Crumlin with my own children. The conditions for patients and for healthcare workers in Crumlin and Temple Street are completely unacceptable, right? So I hear that, nurse, and there is frustration from some clinicians. I fully accept that. Counter to that, the hospital that they will be working in will just be night and day compared to where they are.
And there might be bussed in and there might be remote parking and all the rest of it, and others will be expected to get the Lewis or the train to Houston Station or the buses or whatever. Final question for you, Stephen. You're doing, as you pointed out, a lot of good work and a lot of stuff is in progress. Are you kind of resentful a bit that your successor might get kudos for all the work that you've put in?
No.
And that successor will say, look what I did.
No, not at all. Like, my passion is healthcare. I asked for the brief 5 years ago. You know, I think it is one of the biggest and most important transformations in our country, in our republic. There is a long way to go. Too many people are still waiting too long to see a consultant or to get a scan or to get surgery. Too many patients every day are still waiting on trolleys. Too many people, especially children with rare diseases, are waiting for new medicines and new things to happen. We're only halfway through. It was always going to be a 10-year turnaround. And so what I passionately want to see is whoever comes into office taking credit for all of these things, because that means it will have happened. You know, we have to be, look, there has been really important progress. Like, waiting times have halved. People said that couldn't be done. There's 13,000 less people were on a trolley last year compared to the previous year. But there are far too many people on trolleys. Right now, as you and I speak, there are far too many people on trolleys in far too many hospitals. People are still waiting too long for care. However, in 2020, things were moving in the wrong direction for patients. They're now moving in the right direction. So what I want to see more than anything is the incoming Minister for Health being able to stand up and say, we've met the 10 to 12 week targets. The people of Limerick finally have, and the Midwest finally have, the service, emergency service that they need. We've opened the new hospitals. We've built thousands of new beds. We've transformed women's healthcare. You know, e-health has now been rolled out. To be honest, I want that more than anything, because that'll mean that the work we've done over the last 4.5, 5 years and the momentum that is needed has continued. Because it's all well and good me saying things are getting better and, you know, a lot of progress has been made. We need to be very humble and we need to recognise that there's still a long way to go. The productivity work is still quite new. It needs to embed. It's quite technical. It has to happen. So I really hope that I see the next healthcare minister taking credit for all sorts of good things.
All right. Stephen Donnelly, outgoing Minister for Health, thank you very much for joining us.
Green Scene on the Pat Kenny Show with AIB, offering Irish businesses practical knowledge and support to become more sustainable. AIB, for the life you're after.